Please to be seated. So I don't know if it's progress, but this may well be the first time I need my new glasses to read my sermon. Or I'll just get lost a lot. So I want to look at one particular reading that we have chosen for today. There may be reference to the others, but I'm pretty sure that what Jesus said is on this occasion, relatively self-explanatory and really hard. So I'm going to move to Joseph and a story we hear very, very rarely. In fact, it's been over a decade since I last heard that story read in church. These are the readings for Proper Seven. And it's very rare that we have a seventh after Epiphany because Lent keeps creeping up on us and then suddenly saying, okay, we're into Lent now, forget the Epiphany season. So here we are, a story that we know really well, I'm sure. Although I suspect more of us have heard about it through Joseph and the amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat than we have hearing it read out loud in church. But, you know, having started with a bit of blinded by the light, you can tell my references may go directly to pop culture, because I should really have said, thou whose almighty word, and gone on to let there be light, because then that would have been a properly churchy reference. But I love pop culture, and I confess I really like musical theater. So I'm very fond of Joseph, having been in the chorus in a school production as a kid, and then when I was a vicar in Devon playing the vaunted role of Pharaoh, the Elvis impersonator. I was a-wandering along by the banks of the river when seven fat cows came out of the Nile. I still got it. Thank you so much. There's a kind of Nancy Pelosi clapping going on in the choir, I think. Anyway, moving on. Enough reverie. It's interesting how we form a picture of Bible stories when we only have vague memories. Most of my memories are vague. When we heard them long ago, probably, perhaps even as far back as Sunday school, or when we watched them on stage through a particular interpretive framework. So having read today's scripture story from the Hebrew scriptures, I was surprised by how relevant it felt to this week's dual-purpose sermon, which, as usual, both seeks to grapple with the scripture's relevance to our lives and our journey today, as we try every week, and as this sermon also prepares us to approach our vestry meeting with the openness to the work of God and to one another in community, which our annual gathering calls us to. So about these scriptures, I've said it before, I've no doubt I'll say it again. Our scriptures are not literal documents. They are layered with meaning and import, with metaphor and poetry. They resonate with purpose and exist to teach and to challenge and to inspire and to disturb. I have a high view of Scripture. I believe they are a way in which God reveals God's self to us. In fact, in the words of Madeleine L'Engle, though often attributed wrongly to Karl Barth, I take the Bible way too seriously to take it literally. If I tied myself in knots trying to explain that there was an actual six-day creation, or two proto-humans called Adam and Eve, or an ark, or people like Samson, or even today's story of Jacob, I'd be wasting so much time and energy. For the scriptures themselves don't point me that way. Even in 1 Corinthians 15, our verses from today, it was Paul trying to say, don't take this stuff literally. Look at the deeper meaning behind what's being said about resurrection and new life. It's as if when we open our scriptures, God's saying, look for me, find me. Not saying, explain me, or excuse my genocide, or this is why I have these exclusive set of rules. Again, I think much of the way that we take, when people take scripture literally, goes against the very essence of the divine being, which is love. John Dominic Crossan says, and I know I've shared it before, in fact, quite recently, my point, once again, is not that those ancient people told literal stories and we're now smart enough to take them symbolically, but that they told them symbolically and we're now dumb enough to take them literally. That means that with today's story, as with all our biblical stories, we have a task to perform in community as we gather, to ask what it's here for. And the nature of Scripture is that what we see today, we may not see tomorrow, or next week, or next month, or whenever we open up that story again. So Genesis 45, today's Hebrew Scripture reading, resonates for me right here, right now, because it talks about how we view our past, how we live into the now, and how we move into the future. I can't think of any better themes to hold to in our vestry week. No matter how we view this story, literal or otherwise, this has plenty to say to us. In essence, as I wrote in our summary of the readings that appeared in the bulletin last week, I see this as about Joseph's choice not to exact some kind of revenge upon his brothers for the harm that they had done to him, but to seek meaning and the hand of the divine, not necessarily manipulating the actions of Joseph and his brothers, but making the most of even the worst that can happen. For the story itself is written like a fairy tale, or perhaps more accurately, a folk tale, where everything fits together carefully and beautifully. Despite the pain on the way, everybody lives, in those famous words, happily ever after. But in the way of Scripture, such a simplistic reading is impossible. Our Bible makes it clear that this was not an easy journey. It talks of the pain of Jacob, Joseph's father, believing his son, his favorite, was killed by a wild animal. It talks of the pain and the despair that Joseph goes through being imprisoned. And in today's part of the story, we see of the fear that Joseph's brothers held when he reveals his identity to them. In the wonderfully understated verse 3 of chapter 45 of Genesis, our translation says, his brothers could not answer him, so dismayed were they at his presence. Which is a very genteel way of saying what the New International Version translation says, they were terrified of him. Seems to make more sense. His brothers were afraid of the past, perhaps. At least that's what the passage says to me. It begs the question, how do we hold on to the past in our community? Not that it's a bad thing to hold on to values, experiences, and traditions, but not to hold them as important in themselves, but as important to our journey. Gustav Mahler is reputed to have said, tradition is not the worship of ashes, but the preservation of fire. It's easy to settle into an attitude of, well, I like it this way, so I want it to stay this way. And I find myself falling into that mindset repeatedly, rather than thinking in terms of what's best for my community, what's best for those beyond the walls, perhaps what's best even for me if I can get out of my own comfort zone. It can happen when I come to worship and things are different to what I like or what I want. It can happen when the feel of my space changes. It can happen when the way in which people speak about my community changes. It can happen when things are reported in a different way in the annual meetings. All of this can leave us feeling adrift, and we can often turn to the past and try and inhabit it rather than turning to each other and to God in finding our security. If I may digress for a moment, my guilty pleasure at the moment, well, it's not guilty, it's kind of sweet. Sunday evening, I watch a television show called God Friended Me, which is about a young man who is an atheist who gets a friend request on Facebook from God, or something he and his friends call the God account. And this friendship results in various adventures where Miles, the main character, ends up doing a lot of good in a lot of lives, but remains an avowed atheist. Despite that, he opens his heart and his mind to encountering the world and other people in a different way. And in a rather lovely twist to the story, his father is a rector in an Episcopalian church in New York. And one of the recent plot twists is that the diocese sends a young curate to, quote, update the church, including connecting the parish to social media. And his father resists, but comes around to the need to engage with new ways of thinking and doing, and likewise finds his heart and mind open to new possibilities. In a twist at the end of the last episode, though, it turns out the PC are seeking to replace him with this young curate, but don't let that spoil the life lesson that goes before. I see in myself and in us as community that struggle with the past and the present and the future. How much is holding on to tradition a celebration of where we come from and the sharing of treasures from the great story of our faith? But how much is it holding on to a bygone age? How much are we willing to allow change to stretch and to transform us? But how much is too much? I don't have answers. But our story today shows a stark contrast between the dismayed, terrified, or dumbfounded, depending which translation you read, brothers living in the fear and the guilt of their past, and the liberated joy of Joseph, finally able to reveal who he truly is, and recognizing God's hand even in painful times. It is, I believe, our message for today, our message for Vestry, our message for our community. Hold on to that which is good, but do not allow the past to color our path negatively. Don't allow anxieties or fears or bad experiences to define who we are now and who we are going to be. Let us open our hearts and our minds to the grace of God, to the hope of our shared life together. In working together, we can continue to grow, to celebrate our life together, and to live as Christ calls us. I want to leave you the words of Dag Hammarskjöld, one time, perhaps the greatest General Secretary of the United Nations. For all that has been, thanks. And to all that will be, yes.